Welcome to episode 11 of season 2 of the Ubuntu UK podcast. It's Friday the 14th of August 2009, and in this episode we're going to interview Richard Johnson, who's a core developer working mainly on Kubuntu. We'll cover the latest news and events and have some command line love. We'll have a segment called
Who Do You Think You Were?
Excellent. Then we'll do the competition, ecosphere and feedback.
It's not the ecosphere.
Well, we'll talk about that at the time.
Yeah.
I'm Alan, and with me this week is Tony.
How you doing, Al?
Not bad. What have you been up to this week?
I finished upgrading all my servers. Hooray! Which is what I was talking about last time.
Oh, right.
That's mainly it. I've been working on a couple of secret media projects.
You keep talking about this secret project, and it's really annoying because I don't know what it is.
Laura does.
We're going to pin Laura down and tickle her until she tells.
Oh, my.
Well, there we go. Thank goodness the webcams aren't working. So I've been using Ubuntu and stuff for that, but I haven't really been doing much technical geeky stuff other than that. But,
cool.
You know, it's been interesting and fun. The thing that I have found is a little application called Stills to DV, which uses FFmpeg and it uses Encode DV and things. And you know, on documentaries, where you have a still photograph, and the style these days, I think it's after a guy called Ken Burns, is like you start off with a part of the picture and it sort of pans out,
yep,
sort of slowly over sort of 10-15 seconds or so.
Mm-hmm.
And then sort of by the end of the little bit of clip, you've kind of panned out to the whole photograph.
Like a screensaver.
Like the Mac style screensaver or
right.
Whatever, yeah. That you can generate those in DV format, which will give you a little bit of a clue of the sort of things I've been doing with my secret project. But so I found that as a really useful tool.
Cool.
You're almost interested, aren't you?
No, I'm just hurrying along to ask someone else. Simon, what have you been up to?
Nothing really geeky, to be honest. Nothing Linuxy.
Falling over in the woods.
The only two things of note are spraining my ankle really rather well last night during an 8-mile run in the dark.
See, I keep telling you, this exercise arc.
Yeah, it's not good for you.
If you'd driven, that wouldn't have happened.
Good idea. Well, where I was running, I couldn't actually drive, but that was part of the problem. The only other thing
couldn't walk either.
The only other thing is moving 4 tonnes of topsoil and 35 square metres of turf on Monday, which was great fun.
I assume you did that in more than one journey. Yeah, you didn't.
No, I had it delivered and then threw all the mud on the ground and threw grass on top
of it. Are you building a hill fort?
Yes, in my back. No, it's a burrow mound in my back garden.
Excellent.
Is this after the kids have been mucking around with the computers?
That's right. No, you can't go on the internet. Get in the mound. Go on then, now. What have you been up to, mate?
I was going to ask Dave, but feel free. I reinstalled my desktop because I wanted to switch from 32-bit to 64-bit. And one thing that we keep saying that you can't do with a live CD is install and do a RAID configuration easily.
Software RAID.
Yeah, software RAID, Linux, mirroring. I've got two disks and I want to mirror. Yeah, MDADM. Well, there's a new tool that's come into Karmic. It's developed by guys at Red Hat, and it's called GNOME Disk Utility. And it lets you manage RAID devices. And it's a graphical tool, and it's on the live CD now for Karmic onwards. And it lets you create RAID sets and stuff.
Red Hat do bring us some quite cool stuff, really.
They certainly
they do.
Good
things. Yes. So why did you need to switch to 64-bit? Any particular reason? Or
Because the desktop has... Oh, well, I, yeah, okay. The desktop's got 8 gig of RAM, and 32-bit only sees...
4 gig.
Up to 4 gig. But if you install, there is a kernel on 32-bit called Linux Generic, or Linux Image Generic PAE.
Uh-huh.
And if you install that, then it can see all 8 gig. So you don't have to actually switch to 64-bit to see your RAM.
I thought this issue was with your BIOS of your actual computer rather than...
The BIOS can limit it as well.
No, there was a bug that you can only see 3.2 or something.
That's on my laptop, not my desktop.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, my laptop, I'm staying on 32 gig. There's 32-bit, there's no point going 64-bit on my laptop. But on my desktop, it's got 8 gig and I wanted to use it all.
Yeah, because you did actually do some benchmarks about a year ago and you did see a small but... possibly significant improvement, didn't you?
I've not done a benchmark.
Yeah, you did about a year ago. I remember.
No, I haven't.
Oh, it must have been different, Popey.
That was an insanely geeky
thing. I have run
thing.
Geekbench, the benchmarking tool, but I don't think I run it under 32 and 64 on the same machine.
Okay, Dave, what about you?
Picked me last this time. I thought I was getting way a bit.
Yeah, sorry, did I catch you by surprise?
I thought I was getting way a bit. I've actually been working on two main things regarding with the Ubuntu server. One of them has been trying to get Asterix, which is the popular PBX telephone server, into Karmic, basically upgrade to a new version. Because, to be honest, we don't do a lot of work with the actual telephone stuff in Ubuntu. We do inherit pretty much everything from Debian.
Is that out of date then or something?
No, it's still supporting. It still gets security updates, but we weren't getting more features. Now, it was really mine and someone else's intention to try and get 1.6 into this one, give it a good bit of testing for the next LTS, because we're still not sure whether Karmic Plus 1 is going to be LTS or not. And I think it's kind of good to try and make that leap before an LTS. Although we have had this discussion before that a 6 month release shouldn't be considered like a development one or a testing one. In some ways, in that respect, I think it would be okay to try and get some testing in before the next LTS, because there's no way 1.4 can still be in LTS, because it will probably won't last whole period.
Because it'll be 5 years support on the server, being a server application.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And the other thing, you said there was two things.
Yes, the other thing. Something which actually I was hoping we'd suggest Simon, and Simon might bring a lot of love to this. Now, love is a big hint. Ubuntu server tips. Now, this is something which is, I mean, we all have really some quite awesome things we all do on our servers and things like that that make general administration quite easier. So some little gems there. And the idea is to try and collect them all into a package where either... By running a particular command, it will return a little gem or nugget of goodness.
Like fortune cookie.
It is actually using fortune.
Right. Oh, is it?
Yes,
oh,
yeah.
Cool.
Now, the other thing is the current roadmap is to actually replace the actual copyright information when you first log in. The idea is you'll see it once when you first log in.
Right.
And then in future, you won't see that. So rather than wasting that space, use a tip.
That's quite a good idea.
Yeah, so I've been trying to collect a whole bunch of them, and there was a blog post out, and I was quite pleased that, you know, about 20 come in within the first sort of half hour or so of that. So I was really pleased with that. The other problem is trying to actually get translations, because obviously you don't necessarily want to see it in English if that's not your native language.
Yeah.
Now, Launchpad does actually make this quite easy. Now, I've been translating to British, which has not been too difficult, to be honest. which has not been too difficult. But yeah, so, you know, if you've got any tips, then, you know, try and track down my blog post. It'll be in the show notes.
We'll put a link in the show notes to your blog post and where people can send their tips to.
Yeah, because it's really easy. And, you know, if you've got anything really good, bring it along.
Cool.
Thanks a lot. Sounds like a fun-packed show.
Okay, so we've actually got an interview with Richard Johnson, of fame of Kubuntu work, and also of the Motu Council. Do you want to tell us a bit about yourself, Richard?
Been with the Ubuntu community now for, I don't know, since about 2005, working mainly in the Kubuntu area, the blue-headed stepchild operating system. Just kidding, Mark. Yeah, I've, you know, been able to... move up in the community, I guess you could say, and work with the various councils. I know last year I was at a local show, and they were announcing and saying, this guy is like on more councils than anyone can imagine. So, but I'm no longer on the Kubuntu Council. I've been replaced because I've done my year. Still on the regional membership board stuff. So, besides the Kubuntu stuff, I've been a KDE member and developer since the 90s sometime, while I was in the military, actually. Other than that, that's pretty much it.
So, when did you first get into Ubuntu and Kubuntu? And what, I guess, obviously, you've been using Debian for a while, but what drew you towards the Ubuntu community?
I was actually spying for another distro. It's honest to God truth. I was actually using Meepus at the time, and... You know, Ubuntu came out, and I was never a GNOME user or fan. I had used it a couple of times back in, like, the late 90s, early 2000s. And, I came to Kubuntu and, you know, had my little hidden alias that I don't use today. So I wasn't Nixternal then. I was hiding. But, I came in and tried to get some information and whatnot, and I kind of hung around and just saw the way everybody interacted. And I was like, you know what, this is pretty cool. So I hung around, and then finally one day I decided, okay, I'm going to disconnect, change all my IRC settings, And I pretty much joined back in 2005 after talking with like Jonathan Riddle and Sarah Hobbs and all the old timers back then.
So you sort of came out of the closet as an Ubuntu user.
Yeah.
Excellent.
I think clearly you have to, with that said, you have to tell us what your original nickname was, because it must be something embarrassing.
Honestly, I can't even remember. It was probably Guest 123 or something.
You mentioned a number of councils, and I know Ubuntu is kind of famous for having lots of structure and councils, and one of the boards you're on is the Regional Membership Board. Can you tell us a bit about what that does, what we have to do for that?
Right. What had happened is last year, up until last year, the Community Council was doing all the official Ubuntu membership stuff, and I mean, it just got to the point to where if they were to go through the list of people going for membership, it would have taken them 2 days, you know, in one sitting. So the council come up with the idea that maybe they should split it up into the various regions and whatnot. So I got on the Americas one, obviously, and worked the time zones here. So it's just like what the community council would do, is people who have, you know, spent a little bit of time in the Ubuntu community contributing. It doesn't matter what type of contributions it is, as long as it was sustained. I mean, you could be doing development, support in IRC, support in the forums, you know, you name it. As long as it's, you know, supporting Ubuntu, you're good to go. So after a few months, you know, people apply to become an official Ubuntu member. And when they do that, you know, they have their little application. And on IRC, in the meeting channel, you know, the membership board just sits there and questions them, all kinds of stuff. So we have some guys on the board that are, they're old school. They, you know, make it tough for people to get in and whatnot. And then you have a couple of people, including myself, who are kind of soft and have, you know, have that little spot in the heart where you want everybody to become a member. So
you do a kind of good cop, bad cop thing.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, yeah, we do. So, and it's really funny. Is Cody Somerville will be the bad cop, I'll be the good cop. And then one night he might come in and he's in one heck of a mood and he's the good cop and I'll be the bad cop.
Now, Richard, there's obviously Ubuntu membership you're talking about there.
Right.
But I'm also aware of Kubuntu membership and things like that. How does that differ then? Because with the Ubuntu membership, you get at ubuntu.com email address. And with Kubuntu address, you get at Kubuntu one. Now, I mean, I'm actually a Ubuntu member. But, I mean, I don't actually contribute to Kubuntu or KDE. But if I did, what's the actual difference there?
There actually is no difference. The only difference is you'll do it during a Kubuntu developers meeting. It's the same type of interview process, and yeah, you'll get the at kubuntu.org. So if, say you weren't working in Ubuntu and you're working with Kubuntu, and you didn't go for Ubuntu membership, you know, you were the Ubuntero or whatever, you've signed the code of conduct. So you apply, for Kubuntu membership. So you become a Kubuntu member, as soon as you do that, you also become an Ubuntu member at the same time.
Right.
So, you know, they're two of the same.
You get the same benefits, the Linux Weekly News and
right.
LinkedIn or whatever else.
I don't know if I became a Kubuntu member first or Ubuntu member first. I can't remember now.
Does membership of one automatically follow onto the other, or are they two separate processes?
They're two separate processes.
Okay. We've had a question from Lopter on Identica asking, why might a user who isn't a developer become an Ubuntu member, and does it cost anything?
It'll cost you about 10 to 15 minutes of your life on IRC. That's about it. Did you want to know about benefits?
Yeah, I mean, if you're not a developer, what are the benefits of membership? Why might you become one?
Why might you become one if you're not a developer?
Yeah.
It's kind of, a lot of people kind of say it gives you that feeling of really fitting in. It's kind of like, you know, the same thing as joining like a sorority or fraternity or your local government club, something like that. You know, you just get the support of the community. It's, you know, and it's just, I don't know what the heck you would call it.
You also get voting rights, don't you? On certain things like voting for the CC and stuff, you get, I think, Ubuntu members get a vote on some things. Plus you get the Linux Weekly News subscription for free and a few other things.
Yeah, I forgot about that. I haven't looked at that in a while. I have to fire that up now and get the reading.
So how long does the membership last? Does it last forever or a year or 2 years or what?
It doesn't lasts forever. I mean, it lasts forever, but it doesn't. What happens is when we go ahead and mark you as a member in Launchpad, I think by default you get like 2 years. I can't remember. Mine just expired, as a matter of fact.
Yeah, yours did today. Actually, yours did twice, I noticed.
Yeah, because what happened is I went to re-enable myself, and it doesn't allow you to re-enable yourself, I guess.
Oh.
So, yeah.
Oh, no, not if you've expired. It does before you expire.
If
you catch it just before it expires, you can renew yourself for another year.
I would have known about it, but stupid Gmail flags all my Launchpad mail as spam.
Possibly useful in some ways.
Presumably the code.google.com developers slipping that little filter in.
Yeah, I think marking all your Launchpad, which, you know, that's where all the sort of development of Ubuntu is actually planned, and Kubuntu, for a core developer, which is probably not that helpful, it being marked as spam.
Right.
Cool. Dave mentioned core developers, and explain what the difference between just a Motu, a master of the universe who's a developer in Ubuntu, and a core developer. What's the separation? What's the difference there?
Well, the only difference between a Motu, which is master of the universe, and a core dev is Motu only maintain packages in the universe and multiverse repositories. Those are the only ones they have upload rights to.
Okay.
A core developer has upload rights to main, which is pretty much everything that's going to be on a CD. So a core developer actually has the ability to really ruin your day.
So,
a Motu can do it as well, but it's you know, with the core developer, I mean, you're talking like the kernel, all the KDE core packages or GNOME core packages or XFCE core packages. They all sit in main, and they're the ones that get on the CD.
So, I mean, obviously one of your positions is being on the Motu Council, so you actually get to pick when people become, actually get approved as Motu members. Is that correct?
Yes, it is.
So without going too much into that, what's the actual process to actually get there?
The process for becoming a Motu is definitely different and a little bit more difficult than becoming a regular Ubuntu member. So what you do is, you know, you spend a few months with some sponsors on IRC, work on packages and stuff like that. And after you've built up a decent set of packages that you've uploaded and your sponsors can sit there and say that you've done good on all your packages, even if you lack in some spots and they say, for instance, we had one guy, he lacked in copyrights. He always would mess up a copyright file. But because, you know, when he would go to do his copyright file, the first thing he would do is he would check with other members and say, hey, does this look okay? And because of that, you know, we still said, yeah, okay, he can be a Motu. He understands it. If he has any questions, we know he'll go somewhere and whatnot.
Right.
So, as long as you get some packaging, some bug fixing in for a few months, and I mean, your packaging skills don't have to be, I mean, dead on 100%. As long as it's really, you know, you have really good packages, you're willing to learn, you work great in the community, then Motu is really easy to get. So, and the thing with the Motu Council also, we also recommend core developers to the technical board.
And to be a Motu, do you really need to be a developer? Do you need to be a C programmer?
Oh, no, not at all. No, I mean, I've worked. As a matter of fact, I've only been messing with Python now for, I don't know, just over a year. I was never a big fan of it. I was like, I can do the same stuff with Bash. But I was doing Python packages and actually helping some of the people even patch Python packages without even knowing Python. So, no, you don't need to know the code.
Okay, cool.
I mean, I've done GNOME packaging, and Lord knows I don't know GTK or just flat-out C as well as I do C++.
So it's more important to know about the structure of a package and how a package is built.
Exactly. I mean, as long as you understand, I mean, you need to be somewhat decent with the command line first off, you know. If you can untar a package, go ahead and build it manually and everything, you're on your way.
Okay, so the actual Motu deal with the stuff which is not installed by default, so that's in the universe repository, yeah?
Correct.
Now, presumably that's a prerequisite to becoming a core developer, where you look after the one stuff that's in the main repository. Now, how do you actually get approved to be a core developer?
Well, first off, Motu isn't a prereq. You can go straight to core dev.
Hmm.
Yeah,
if you're an employee of Canonical, for example.
You come in and you do nothing but work on the kernel, why would you need Motu?
Right.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Core Dev is, I mean, on the Motu console side, when we interview the core developer applicants, we pretty much do it the same way as we do Motu. Because that's only part one. Part two is they got to go to the tech board now and get hammered by those guys. And when I say hammered, I mean hammered.
Right.
They really get into stuff. And, yeah, the tech board's scary, to be honest.
So, what, like going, asking very deeply technical questions about development and packaging and stuff before you, you know, and make sure you understand the process, that kind of
thing. Right. Yeah, I mean, and they'll hammer, I mean, really, really deep on stuff. So, I mean, if you, you know, when you go do your core dev application, one thing I recommend is do not be general at all. I mean, be right to the point, be precise. Because if you're general, you know, say, I can say, I've worked on a package and patched gconf. More before you know it, they're asking me all kinds of gconf questions, and I'm just, I'm nailed, I'm hammered, I don't know what to do.
Right.
Okay, so you've really got to know your stuff in order to get through the technical board.
Right.
But what are the specific aspects that you're looking at on when you're doing your evaluation? How do you tell who'd be a good person? That they participate in the community? Or?
Right. Well, most of the time, people that are going for core developer, most of us have worked with over the years. I mean, on all the applicants that we've done for core devs, nobody has, you know, it hasn't been somebody we haven't known or we, you know, we had to really go, okay, who's this person and whatnot. They, you know, we've known these people. We know they do good work. And we know that the technical board's going to approve them. There has been an occasion where we let them go through and a technical board didn't approve them only because that person was general on their application. And when they were going through the tech board hammered them on one point. So
right.
We're technical when we do our stuff with the Motu Council, without a doubt. Most of the stuff, you know, we pretty much know the people already, so it makes it much easier on our part.
And there are some people, as I understand it, there's Motu, there's Core, and there's some people who have an exception. So they only maintain one package in Core.
Right.
Isn't it? So for example, like the Wine project, there's like one package or one guy who maintains that, and he's not necessarily a core developer, but he can maintain that package. Is that right?
Right. He just has access right to that package.
Yeah.
There's another one too. I think Emacs is the other one.
okay.
We're actually working on an applicant now that's trying to get upload rights for one package. I can't remember what package it is. We haven't done much of it, to be honest, so the policy around it, I know Davey loves policies and stuff like that, so the policy around it is actually still being designed as we're actually approving people. It's all going to change with the archive reorg, and I know I should not. I just stuck my foot in my mouth with that one.
You guys, yeah, because actually, we're going to ask you about that.
Because archive reorg, that's something that's been discussed for a little while now, hasn't it?
I have no idea what that is.
But hang on. Before we go on to that, can I just ask one more thing? So we've been talking about Motu, you know, so Ubuntu developers and Ubuntu core developers.
Right.
Now, so something I think might interest our listeners is, what's the difference between a developer for Ubuntu and and like an upstream developer for another project? So, I mean, do they actually work on the code, or is it just the packaging? I mean, how does that work?
Now, when you say developer, you're also, the way that I look at it is anybody who does any type of development work, whether it's community development, artwork development, documentation development, code development, package development, you're a developer in my eyes.
Right.
So the difference really, I mean, and the same thing goes with an upstream developer. The big difference between a downstream or a distribution developer is, a distribution developer, a lot of people see them as just someone who's doing the packaging. So really, they're nothing more than they're just a
packager. Get yourself in trouble there.
You know what I mean? Yeah, right. And upstream developers, you know, are people that, well, you know, the common misconception, I guess I should say, is they're the people who are writing the code. But a developer is anybody who's developing anything anywhere that's helping the community or the project itself.
Right.
So that's where I have one of my stuff.
Okay, so you touched on the archive reorg there.
Oh, man, here we go.
Can you, as I was saying, that's something that's been planned for a while now. Can't you tell us a bit about what it is and how it's going to work?
No.
Excellent.
No, how it's going to work, oh, man. The archive reorg is, we're going to reorganize the thing where you're not going to have like your main universe and everything. All the packages are going to be in one archive. And what this does now is, like, we were just talking about how Wine has a one person who can work on the packaging and upload and whatnot. Well, that's going to be the main thing about one of the big things about the archive reorg is, like, the Kubuntu project. We don't have to send people, once it's complete, if it ever gets complete, which I'm sure it will soon. But when it does, is now we get people coming in and working on Kubuntu. We don't have to send them to become a Motu so they can get upload rights to Universe, which really doesn't help Kubuntu much because we really need core devs. Excuse me. So, you know, we don't have to send them that whole process. What we can do as Kubuntu is say, hey, listen, we have this whole, and the names aren't even, I don't even know what you want to call them. I called it a snowflake at UDS out in Mountain View. So it's kind of like the seeds for Kubuntu. We can give a person rights to work on the Kubuntu packages only. And it's, you know,
so it's a lot more atomic. You have
right.
teams who are looking after packages which are related to each other in terms right. of functionality rather than grouped together by right. very high level, you know, main universe and so on.
Yeah, and I mean, that could all change. We, you know, the talks have been going on forever. I've been in on conference calls with, you know, Canonical and stuff like that, working on this whole thing, and boy, my eyes crossed, you don't know how many times during all those conversations.
So it's not something that's going to happen anytime soon, within the next, say, 6 months or so?
6 months? I hope so. It
oh, really?
Should. But we also said that at Mountain View.
So Richard, would there be potential there for you actually to lose your upload rights to, say, GNOME or GNOME packages? Because obviously yeah. you're mainly focused on Kubuntu. Yeah. So would you actually have that privilege taken away?
One of the things we had brought up when we were at UDS in Mountain View, on the back end side, on like the community management side with the Motu Council and the tech board, is what do we do about people that are core developers right now, or Motu, that, you know, have access to an entire repository? Once this kicks in, if they switch me to Kubuntu, I lose access to working on non-Kubuntu stuff, which I don't know how much of that there is out there that I've actually worked on. So there's, you know, possibly there's going to be some people that are going to keep that, you know, keep the entire rights to everything. There is potential that I lose my rights to everything, which is no biggie since I work mostly on KDE stuff, and I have no problem poking people, telling them to upload stuff for me. I did it for 2 years before I even thought about becoming Motu, so.
Isn't there going to be a lot of crossover? So, for example, there's like a GNOME Bluetooth applet and a KDE Bluetooth applet, and then there's the core Bluetooth stuff underneath.
Right.
And there's going to have to be a lot of cross-communication between those people who look after those three separate things, if they are indeed separate teams of people.
Which is something that you brought up a great point there, is it's something I hope happens right there. Because in the past with Kubuntu, and I mean, it's Kubuntu's fault just as much as anybody else's. Our cross-communication has been null and void, really. There hasn't been much. With Karmic now, we've actually been working really close with GNOME developers, the Ubuntu developers, with the, was it Ayatana, the desktop craziness? We've been working with those guys, and if you read Jonathan Riddle's blog here recently, he posted one of the first things that come out of the Ayatana project for KDE. With Karmic, we've been working closely with GNOME developers, Ubuntu developers, and yeah, it's something that I wish that had been going on for a long time.
Now, just before we wrap up, I see on your webpage that you talk about you're an associate member of the Free Software Foundation. Do you still think? Okay, right. I was going to ask why you went ahead and became an associate member, and whether you think the Free Software Foundation is still relevant today.
Well, let me just start off and say I let it expire.
Like your Ubuntu membership, apparently.
Right. I have no problem with the Free Software Foundation. They have a ton of great people, amazing people, and they have a lot of good ideas. The only problem is, you know, they've done stuff like this whole Bad Vista campaign. They come out and say it was a win. I don't know who it was a win for, because I sure in the heck didn't feel like I won anything. And I'm seeing more rhetoric than I am good coming out of there now. And, you know, someone like Benjamin Mako Hill, I would love to see him become like the leader of the whole thing, because that guy is brilliant. Stallman, I'm a Stallman fan. You know, I'm not going to lie about that. But is confusing about as much as George W. Bush was.
That's probably a good place to leave that, I think.
Yes.
Well, I think we've probably talked to you all day, but I guess we better cut it there. So thanks very much, Richard. It's been a pleasure speaking to you. And,
well, it's not over yet. I have to fix you guys on something.
Oh, yeah, go on.
Oh, look out.
Your last podcast, you called it the Kubuntu Netbook Remix.
Yeah.
Right, okay.
Davey knows because I gave him hell on IRC.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah.
It's actually the Kubuntu Netbook Edition, so it's...
okay.
It's official.
Awesome stuff. I'm actually running it right now on my little Inspiron Mini 10V.
Is that KDE 4.3?
Right now it's 4.3. Actually, the Netbook Edition that's being worked on upstream in KDE... that a lot of the Kubuntu developers are actually helping with is being built for 4.4. So we've had to go in and, you know, hack up the libs a little bit so we can get it to work with 4.3. I'm running it right now. It's pretty impressive. I'm missing a few things, but, you know, we still have time to work stuff out.
So
this whole network mangler thing is getting on my nerves. GNOME network managing applet.
That's a pretty everyday occurrence, surely.
The only one that works.
So for the geeks here, the difference between a remix and an edition is what?
Why do you have to ask that question?
well, you called us on it being a remix or an edition and not, and we got it wrong. So tell us what the difference is.
There's differences. What they are, I really don't know. The whole containment, for one, in the Netbook edition isn't running on top of like the regular KDE desktop like UNR does.
Right.
Ubuntu Netbook Remix, how they have that little thing that just sets on the desktop.
Right, yes.
This is like an entire containment. So the nice thing about KDE is the containment. So you have a desktop containment that we use, you know, everybody's pretty much familiar with. So for the netbooks, we have a containment for it. That's a whole netbook one. It's got that netbooky feel, I guess you would say, as Mario from Dell put it the other day on IRC to me. The one thing that we're trying to do with the Netbook edition for KDE is try to make it so it doesn't take up so much screen real estate like the other ones are, like Jolly Cloud or Moblin.
So not going to have lots of big clocks.
All that stuff, so. What was that?
I'm not going to have lots of big clocks and a great big panel.
You know, there was one great big clock when I first fired it up.
Fuzzy clock, yay!
I removed that clock. I got on my nerves.
Yeah.
Was that Alan that just brought up the whole clock thing?
Yes.
Yeah, I have a bone to pick with you too, mister. UDS Mountain View.
Yeah.
You were out on the steps so happy with your KDE 4 laptop.
Yeah.
And dude, like the next podcast you guys do, I've gone back.
That was, I think that was about 2 months later. Probably 2.5.
Yeah.
I
podcast, and I could totally see you with your tail between your legs on that one. I was like, no.
I had Kubuntu on my laptop for a good couple of months.
This is when you committed to run it for 6 months, no matter what.
Yep, and then I just found myself getting so frustrated with it.
Right. It's the same thing when I use GNOME. It's the same thing. But I've run GNOME. I'm looking at GNOME on my desktop now, actually, at the KDE website.
No.
But, yeah, I find myself getting, you know, the same way. I get flustered with some of the stuff. You know, you're not used to it.
Yeah.
Yeah, Alan's quite easily confused by technology.
Yeah, I mean, I understand. So.
Thanks for helping keep KDE contained. And it was, and so that was really good. Well, thanks, Richard. Yeah, thanks for talking to us.
Thank you so much.
Same here, guys.
It's time for the news. Two Google security experts discovered a flaw which affects 8 years worth of Linux kernels. The bug could allow a local user on a Linux system to gain root privileges. It's been patched for future kernels, but clearly there's a lot of potentially affected systems in the wild.
Well, I think it's worth noting that it's a local exploit, so you actually already have to have an account on the actual server in order to be able to do it.
So if it's shared hosting or something.
Yeah.
If you run like a
DreamHost.
Yeah. I was going to say, I bet DreamHost have a bit of a panic attack at the moment.
Yeah.
And most other ISPs that have any kind of web space that gives you a shell account.
VPSs for the win.
Yeah. I did actually try an example exploit code on Jaunty, and that wasn't vulnerable, but someone else I saw reported that it was.
So. I see, Case Cook, who works in the security team, has replied that all Ubuntu releases since 8.04 are not vulnerable, and then gives a description of why in some technical detail.
Watch out for your updates then.
ID Software have announced that Quake Live is now available for Mac and Linux.
Nightmare.
As well as Windows.
Nightmare.
Why?
Well, Quake was the first game I ever played on a PC, and I got horribly addicted to Quake Live. Horribly addicted.
Actually, I have to agree, Half-Life was the very first game I tried on network play, and I was playing people for about, you know, 10 minutes and talking and saying, look, come on guys, you know, come on, and then realised I was actually playing bots.
Do you know, the really sad thing is, my first network game, I think, was Rogue.
NetHack over Telnet?
It was Rogue on terminals at a company that would let you run it for 2 hours at lunchtime. And then the programme was switched off after 2 hours.
Terrible.
I'm not that old.
Canonical and the Ubuntu Firefox maintainers got a bit of a kicking from Karmic users last week. The objections centred around an experiment conducted by the Ubuntu Mozilla team, which modifies the Google search options in the browser to use the custom search engine. The change has now been reverted as the experiment ended.
Yay!
What was the custom search engine?
Well, if you... you know, you can put a custom search engine on your website. You can go to Google and get some code to put on your website so that you have a little search box. And so people can search either your site or the whole internet using that thing, right?
Yeah.
Well, if you ever use one of those, you'll notice that you don't get the full Google experience. So when you type something in and search, you don't get images, news, groups, and all that kind of stuff along the top.
It's Google without all the good stuff.
Yeah, it's Google minus Google, basically. Google Lite. And what they did was they put that in all of the methods that you search. So if you type something directly in the awesome bar, or if you type in the little Google thing in the top right-hand corner, or the home page, which incidentally was hardwired in the browser. Yes. So when you open a new tab, you get a Google search page. You always get the custom search engine, and it was kind of horrible.
Free software is all about choice.
Well, it wasn't.
It was hard-coded. The
main problem was that it was implemented as a plugin, so you could undo it, you could turn it off. But some people didn't like the fact that Ubuntu were in some way tracking what they were searching for.
Oh no, that wasn't the issue for me. The issue for me is I choose not to use that version custom of Google. Search. I want to use the Google as intended.
Full Google.
Yeah. And the fact that it override my choice from the home settings.
Yeah, even if you change your home page in the browser, it overwrote that.
Yeah, yeah, that really.
But anyway, it's all gone away.
Yay.
Good.
Every Ubuntu defector's favourite distro, Arch Linux, have put out a new release, version 2009.09. Boasting an all-new installer and many bug fixes, this version is sure to be useful for all those who see Ubuntu as far too mainstream.
So, who's used Arch Linux here?
I tried it once.
Nope.
And the installer annoyed me because it was really old school. It looked like a BSD installer. This was last year.
What?
And when I finished the install, it gave me a static IP address.
What's its USP?
I think it's supposed to be more. You can have the option of having rolling updates, so you don't have you don't necessarily have to have a release and stick to it. They do have releases.
Keeps going,
but you could potentially have rolling releases.
In some ways, that's nice.
Mm, yeah, I'm sure it is. Yeah.
After a lengthy kerfuffle, it seems Debian have backtracked on their plan to have time-based freezes. We reported on this in the last episode. In the latest Debian news announcement for version 6, codenamed Squeeze, the release team have announced that a new timeline will be announced in early September. They've announced they're going to announce it.
Yes.
So they're obviously not... I think they thought they wouldn't be able to have all the necessary work done in time for the December freeze this time around, because it was only 4 months away at the time they announced it.
Okay, so they may well announce a time freeze... In the future.
So it's not a complete backtrack. It's possibly just a...
You reckon?
Postponement? Who knows?
I haven't read some of it. I think it's a lot of sacked off Debian developers who really don't want to toe somebody else's line.
What they really need is somebody to loan them an extra load of developers.
Talking of which, Mark Shuttleworth has offered the services of Ubuntu developers to Debian. In an effort to help two projects work together closer, he says there's no secret cabal or skunkwork efforts to influence Debian. Now, the interesting thing is the technical board are actually looking for a prominent Debian developer to be a member as well, aren't they?
That makes some sense. That makes a lot of sense, actually. That's a really good idea.
Yes. They already have at least one.
Well, that's it. I mean,
Colin Watson is a Debian developer.
And he's the Ubuntu installer guy, and he was the Debian installer guy. I don't know if that's what he's still doing.
That's part of what he does, yes. That's part of what he does,
okay. But there were a lot of Debian developers who started to work on Ubuntu and kept putting stuff back into Debian. So, I mean, it's good, you know, support both projects at once. Why not? Go for it.
Yeah.
Microsoft has been banned from selling Word in the US due to a patent dispute. The banning order, which is expected to be appealed, does not cover other elements of Office, but it's expected to cause a software giant a headache for a few months.
Presumably until they write a massive check to somebody.
Well, it is already a massive amount they have to pay, really. Well, not to them, but...
$20 million?
Yeah, something like that. I thought it was $200.
There is also a daily fee as well.
Yeah, that's right. Every day they have to pay this other company some money.
But the thing is that I've noticed on some mailing lists, a lot of people are praising this, like, haha, you know. But I actually see this as a bad thing because we're always arguing that we don't like software patents.
Yep.
And yet when it's actually enforced...
against Microsoft, that makes it all right.
Exactly.
It's somewhat hypocritical.
Yeah. It doesn't make it okay, but maybe... Oh, well.
It's a taste of their own medicine.
It's a taste of their own medicine. Maybe it might make them change their ways.
Yeah, right.
Never can happen.
Dell's senior product marketing manager, Todd Finch, has said that there's no great disparity between returns of Dell notebooks between those shipped with Windows and those shipped with Linux.
And the Linux is Ubuntu, isn't it?
Yes.
On the M10. M10.
So all these things that people have been saying, oh, well, people send back more Linux machines than Windows machines. Well, maybe not.
Yeah, it's just displacing some FUD, I think.
I think in many ways it's the selling practice.
Yeah, we've talked about this before, the people in the stores. And there was a mention on the UK mailing list, who said the guy in the store was actively telling him, you don't want Windows, you don't want Linux, you can't download stuff on Linux, and, you know, all kinds of wacky stuff. Yeah. It was just, you know, it's just someone being clueless. It's not, I don't necessarily think it's malicious, but it's just they haven't necessarily had the training or the experience.
Well, you won't be able to download anything on Windows 7 if they're not shipping a browser. Computer World have published an article called 7 Reasons to Skip Windows 7. Here's a summary. We'll link to the full article in the show notes as usual. Number 1, it's still a security mess. Number 2, it's expensive. Number 3, upgrading generally means a reinstall, not an in-place upgrade. Number 4, no easy way to transfer programs from old to new install. Number 5, XP already works. Number 6, new user interface. Number 7, contrary to what people say, it does suck on netbooks.
Yeah, it's a kind of pro-Linux-y in some ways, but also pro-XP, to be honest.
I haven't actually read this article, but looking at the actual summary, I'm not sure it's going to be completely unbiased, actually.
Unbiased in what way?
Well, as in, as you say, I think it is possibly written by a Linux advocate.
Oh, the guy does say in the last paragraph, he suggests XP users should migrate to Linux and not Windows 7. So,
we also have a new interface.
Yeah, but that's the point. Whether it's a new interface on Windows 7 or a new interface on Ubuntu, that's only one of the 7 reasons not to use it.
Yep, okay. And it's not expensive. Because Linux isn't expensive. It's not a security mess unless you've got one of these vulnerable kernels that's been around for the last 8 years. upgrading means, you can upgrade from release to release, but you have to do some sort of installation and partitioning effort. You can transfer your settings because the Wubi, if you use Wubi, it'll pick up your settings from Windows and transfer that across, won't it? So that's that one. And
XP already works.
It does
works.
Suck on networks, potentially.
What, Ubuntu?
Yeah, it sucks on mine.
Oh, okay.
It's so slow. Well, that's one or two selling points. Sarcasm overload.
So we have some events. We've got the Software Freedom Day. This year is Saturday, the 19th September 2009.
OS Barcamp is also on the 19th September in Dublin, and some of us are going to be there.
Yeah, I'm going, and producer Laura is going, and I know some of you here have still yet to get the necessary permission from other halves to attend.
We need our permission slips.
Yeah.
Yes.
Hopefully somebody else will be there as well. But yeah, it should be good fun.
Also on the 19th of September, there's the Atlanta Linux Fest at the IBM facility on Northside Parkway.
So, hang on, I have to do Software Freedom Day, then go to Ireland, then go to America all in the same day?
Yep. You can try.
Think of the air miles.
You can be like Phil Collins at Live Aid.
He does look quite a lot like Phil Collins.
This has been said before.
LinuxCon, the new technical conference for all matters Linux, is running on the 21st to 23rd of September in Portland, Oregon.
We've got Ohio Linux Fest, which is the 25th to the 26th of September. at the Greater Columbus Convention Center in downtown Columbus, Ohio.
There's going to be a Launchpad community meetup on the 28th of September in London.
And we've got the Ubuntu Global Jam on the 2nd to the 4th of October.
Lug Radio Live 2009 is on the 24th of October, New Hampton Arts Centre in Wolverhampton. And we did mention this very briefly in the last episode, but we're probably worth mentioning it in a little more depth. We've been talking with the Linux Outlaws guys, who are another Linux-related podcast.
You might have heard of.
You might have. They're very good. I listened to an episode, and they were really good. I mean that in a nice way. But, yeah. Anyway. Yeah, so we've been talking with them about having some sort of joint unconference or bar camp type event on the Sunday, the day after the Lug Radio Live, so that's Sunday the 25th. It'll be in Wolverhampton, so it'll be around. So if you've come for the Lug Radio Live on the Saturday and gone out in the evening, hopefully you can still hang around for a bit on the Sunday. We've had a few tweets and a few dents saying people might like to turn up. But if you're interested and just would like to say, yes, that's a good idea, it'd be really good to kind of gauge how many people might like to turn up. So email us or voicemail us or tweet us or dent us or whatever it might be and just say, yeah, that sounds like a good idea. And then
yes,
we'll know.
Just say those words. That's all you
sounds
need
like
to
a good idea. And then sounds like a fun-packed weekend, and we know it's worth putting the effort in to organise.
There is a comedy gig for the benefit of Bletchley Park in Bloomsbury Theatre in London on Tuesday, 3rd of November, with Richard Herring, Robert Llewellyn, Crichton, Robin Ince, and maybe Stephen Fry.
Excellent. This is to raise money for Bletchley Park, because it keeps having
keep
its
it
funding
open.
Cut.
Yes.
Yeah.
Bletchley Park was the thing that did the code-breaking for the World War,
the Enigma machines.
Hmm.
And finally, FOSDEM is on the 6th and 7th of February 2010 in Brussels.
It's time for some more command line love with the one and only Simon.
Oh, it's not love, it's love.
Love. Command line love. Late night
dear
command
me,
line love.
Dear me.
Are we going to get told off by the people who run commandlinefood.org or whatever it is?
Probably.
Only if they listen.
Well, it is a resource, and that's where most of these come from. But, you know, we're just...
we're just blatantly blagging other people's content.
Well, there's that. We have had a few suggestions from the community members, though.
Yeah.
A few tips and things. So they're not all stolen.
They're borrowed under a liberal license.
Come on, IP rights for command line food.
This is true.
We're talking of IP.
So what are you going to serve up for us this time?
Right, this time is a couple, two in fact. Obviously, most applications come with a manual. Go into the terminal, type man and then whatever your app name is, and you get a text manual on the application. That's great, but what about if you... some people can't actually read and take in the information from a screen. I actually struggle with it quite a lot.
Yeah.
I need to see it on paper.
And some of the man pages are gigantic.
Yeah.
And you've got to scroll through pages of stuff.
So not particularly environmentally friendly, but you can, in fact, convert the manuals to a text file or, in fact, a PDF. Once you've done that, you can print them off.
Ah.
And if you're not that environmentally unfriendly, hang on, double negative.
That's right, you're good.
Yeah. And maybe you have an ebook reader or an OLPC that can act as a... ebook reader, then you can put PDFs on that, can't you?
And the thing is, you actually showed me this a few days ago, and I hadn't actually used this before, and I was really pleased to actually include the formatting as well.
It's really useful.
Oh,
yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, so, yeah. It doesn't just create like a standard sort of courier font or anything like that. It actually has the bolds and the...
Oh, nice. You know,
it looks quite nicely laid out, yeah.
Mm.
So you can make your own O'Reilly books.
Cheeky. We've got a great title for this next segment. You may have heard something similar on the television called Who Do You Think You Were?
Oh, I thought it was going to be Come Dancing.
No, no, that's later. That's
really?
Just horrendous. So I had a thought the other day. When you started in the Linux world, or when you started getting into Linux, you sort of were new to the idea. Perhaps you went along to a LUG meeting and you saw all the people who were there, or you had the kind of beliefs... You know, if you came into Linux because of the whole free software thing, and that was what attracted you to it, or maybe you got into it for a pragmatic reason. And we've all been knocking around in the community for a long time now, probably 4, 5, 6, maybe getting on for 10 years in some of our cases. Have we changed over that period? Are we different people now? We've got different values or motivations or priorities. We're doing what we do in terms of Linux. We're kind of still doing the same sort of thing, but do we do it a different way? Have we mellowed in our views? Alan, how did you get into Linux, and what were your motivations when you started?
I first used it as a on a CD that came with a book. Do you know, I really can't remember what... Oh, I know the first guy who said it, told me about Linux, was a guy at where I worked. He was a student at where I worked. And he said, oh, you've got to try this new thing called Linux. And it's really great. And he said it came on 36 floppy disks or something. And I was like, get out. It'll never take off. But equally... within a couple of months of that, one of the lecturers there said, oh, there's this new fantastic Windows. So that's really fantastic. And I went, get out. That. So I am clearly no good at predicting the future.
This Windows thing will never take off.
Exactly. That's pretty much what I said to him. What a fool.
So do you think you were a very different person in terms of your outlook on Linux when you started getting into it?
I think I thought it was deeply technical. I think I thought the whole thing was just... I thought Unix at the time was hard because I'd never really touched it. And I think I thought it was just really madly geeky. And I think now I still think it is.
Okay.
Do you
I thought you were going to say something like, now I think anybody can use it.
Yeah, no, yeah, you're right. I do think it's still madly geeky because you have communities of people who turn up and take computers apart once a month and, you know, and sit around in a room and talk about, you know, drivers and compilers and stuff. So it is still deeply technical, but it's more accessible.
Do you think other people. Do you think that was one of the driving forces of why you actually got involved in Linux was because you thought it was very geeky?
Probably, yeah. I felt an affinity with the people who, because they were similar minded. You know, they were also nerds. You know,
yeah.
I
mean, I can certainly relate to that. I think it's because I think some people have part of their personality to want to succeed at doing something well, and
we clearly don't.
But no. I put myself into that group. So I work hard to try and get good at something. If I'm interested in something, I work hard to get good at it, and I'm sure most people do. But now I'm actually at a stage that I'm not sure I actually value someone else's geekiness to the same level unless they actually use a Linux or Unix variant.
Ah, so you're a geek snob.
I guess so. And I must say that is a fault with me, but I'm always a bit skeptical of someone else's experience.
But I don't think that's. Yeah, I can see that. I've met people who've never known pre-Windows. So, for example, Windows System Admin, who would have started doing System Admin maybe about the era of Windows 98 or NT or something like that. So basically, young people, and you know, you've talked to them about stuff like. DOS and HiMem and EMM 386 and all these words that, you know, conjure images of horrid configurations and DOS and Windows and stuff. And I think, you've missed all that. You've missed that good stuff and you're missing out.
Aren't you amazed that some people don't actually know there's a console on their computer? I mean, for me, I mean, in older versions of Windows, the console was an important part. But now you don't see it at all unless you explicitly look for it on a Windows computer.
So, same question to you then, Dave, as we went to Alan. What were you doing when you first started to get into Linux?
Well, I actually had to check my wiki page, which is horribly out of date. But yes, I mean, I actually started using Linux 10 years ago this year.
Wow.
Yeah. Okay. It was actually in the summer, because I remember the very first time it was a national newspaper, and there was a computer column, and it said, hey, this is this free thing that's just taking off. And that was actually Slackware I tried.
Wow.
Yeah.
So it's the summer now, so it is literally pretty much 10 years since you started.
Yeah, it is. And I actually remember, directly after I installed it, all I got was this black screen, yeah? And I had no idea, I didn't even know how to log in, you know?
So what was it that appealed to you? Why did you think this might be something interesting to try out? Or just geekiness? Or?
I think so, and it's something I wanted to get good at, but I was actually, if you let me finish my story,
sorry.
Yeah, so just after I logged in, I didn't actually know what to do. All I got was this black screen. I wasn't even aware there was a desktop there until one of my friends, who has been using it for a couple of weeks, said, Dave, try typing start X. And I thought, oh, wow, you know, this is actually, you know, it's certainly come on leaps and bounds. But anyway, okay, I'm ready to answer your second question, Tony.
Okay, well, so you were doing proprietary software development and things in the past, but now you work pretty much exclusively with Linux and free software systems.
It has definitely taken over my life in that respect because, you know, I did work doing C++ and Java programming on a Windows desktop. And a couple of years ago, I decided to, you know, that I thought I was at a stage that I could probably match or exceed my income doing something I actually enjoy, and that's working with Linux servers and other related things.
You're living the dream, really.
Well, you say that, but you know, I mean, you like pizza, yeah?
Yeah.
But have you worked in a pizza shop?
Yeah. Okay, fair. So what advice would you give your younger self if you could? Would you say, I would actually,
I think it's such an exciting time at the moment. If I could just get started with it now, I think, you know, things have come on so much. I mean, just in processing it and actually computer power alone, if you could come in now, because there's no doubt in my mind, there's things that took me, you know, months to actually pick up, that actually people coming into it now, it's so accessible that they can pick up. And, you know, I think that people could come to the same sort of level we're at within a couple of months, whereas it's taken us years.
I don't know. I'm not so sure about that. I think you get, it's the same, you still need that backfill of experience. I would say to the person I was all those years ago, when the guy came up to me with 30 floppy disks, take them and play with it, because I didn't. And I think I'm late to the party, and I started using Linux 6 years ago, maybe more.
Yeah, but all the cool people turn up late to a party. It's fashionably late.
Simon, what about you?
Oh, I've been thinking whilst you lot have been waffling on, actually.
cheers.
I can't put a date on it, but I remember my first distro, and that was Red Hat 5. Wow. I think that's around about 8 years ago. Ish. I'm just thinking, trying to think back.
That'd be longer than that, because I was on Red Hat 7 in 2000 or thereabouts.
Red Hat 7 came out when I was at uni, and that was really 10 years ago.
Well, anyway,
You're older than you think you are.
Yeah, I'm not. It stemmed from two real areas. I've always had a problem with ripped off software, and I was, of course, using ripped off software at the time, and it's never sat well, and that was one driving force. But I really wasn't aware of free and open source software at the time. What really got me into Linux was the fact that I am a radio ham, and I wanted to set up a bulletin board, which of course were running all over the internet at the time. Well, radio hams were running them linked into those online bulletin boards over the air, and I wanted to run one. And one of the best bits of software was written by a guy called, I can't remember his call sign, F6FBB. And this stuff ran on Linux. So I got the local nerd around. He installed a version of Red Hat.
Right.
But it was probably pre-alpha, because when I tried to do anything other than run the BBS software, it was horrible. It really, really didn't work at all.
That sounds just like Linux was at that time.
Yeah, you're probably right. But yeah, that was it. And I left the bulletin board, sat in the corner doing its thing, and I'd log in and, you know, look after it a couple of times a day. Liked it, got Red Hat 5, installed it, and yeah, that was it.
We've all had to learn from scratch. There was always a time where none of us in this room had used Linux, and we've started and we've learnt it. But you've been quite public, both on this podcast and sort of blogs and things, about your learning process in terms of getting up to Linux. Would you give yourself any advice, yourself, when you started out?
No, actually, I think I've done it fairly well, in that I went to the people with the knowledge, and the people were the lug. Yeah. And I pestered and I poked, and I said to Bo P, because he was the friendly guy, I said, mate, can you tell me how to do this? Can you tell me how to do that?
How things have changed.
Oh, no.
I remember the first time I met Simon at a lug meet, he was sat behind me about three feet away, and we were talking to each other on IRC, in the Hans IRC channel, and I said, yeah, where are you, mate? And he went, turn around.
So it was love at first sight.
Yeah. Well, it was great.
Something about beards.
He would help. And as I said earlier on, he would help to the point where it was not a case of, I've had enough of helping you. It was a case of, you can find this information for yourself. Google is your friend. And that's really, you know.
See, you've actually picked on something in a personality there, because, I think a lot of geeks don't actually like to ask for help, you know, if they can. So I think sometimes when you get to a certain stage, you actually want to try and find out yourself rather than keep asking people.
I think that's just the technical people that we either were or become because of the power. That's the other thing with Linux.
I'm not convinced it is that people don't want to ask questions. I think it's that people lack the correct skills to be able to ask the right questions of the right people in the right way.
Yeah, because I mean, clearly there's no need to spend a whole day doing something when someone could tell you in 10 minutes.
Oh, I don't know.
There are some belligerent people out there who will sit there for a whole day hacking away at something, and then you come over and go, just type this.
Yeah, I'm hiding.
Yeah, but in that day of searching and trying so hard to get something to work, you learn so much. Mm. It depends on where you're coming from. If you just want to be a user and get on with it, that's not what you should be doing. But we're obviously all quite technical people and enjoy getting into the guts of things. It's part of the fun now.
Mm.
So the same question to you, Tony. Okay. We all met through the lug.
Yes.
I met you first at Portsmouth College, I think.
I never went to a Portsmouth College meeting. No, I met you at Southampton.
But oh, okay.
I remember Alan being shown how to install Debian.
That was when I had... Yeah, I was on Red Hat previously, and everyone badgered me to use Debian.
I remember you sitting there watching all the depackage stuff scrolling past, going, look at what he's doing, stuff.
I was used to installing one package, then going and finding the dependencies, and then doing one more. Yeah.
But I'm a geek, and I got into Linux because of the technical stuff, and what I really liked about it was the ability to kind of customize it and tweak it to your own satisfaction. When I used to look after our family PC at home, we had Windows 98, sort of tweak the boot scripts and stuff to get the settings right, and so that try and help protect my parents from destroying the system, I'd hide certain icons so that when I started it, it would show me all the icons and they'd only have the ones they wanted to use. So, and then when sort of XP and 98 came along, it was harder to do that because there wasn't any user separation and things. So I really liked the idea of a system that would give me max control and almost endless tweakability. So I loved the geeky side. But when I started to read about Linux, I started to get into the whole idea of free software and the fact that it would remove the restrictions. As a student, I found it really frustrating that I couldn't install Office and things legally on my home computer, so I couldn't do my university work. I'd have to go to the university and use the university computer labs, but I could get Star Office as it was then, and later became Open Office and things, and download that and try to use that. It was a bit ropey, but I was trying to use the things that I was legally allowed to use. And the whole idea of, and the logical position of free software being able to continue to, it's the only logical standpoint to take if you want to remove all restrictions on what people can do with their computers, is that everything should be free software.
Mm-hmm.
And for a while, I was kind of like, yes, this must be the case, and I will strive to only use free software. But yet, I still have a job where I'm a network manager or IT manager in a largely proprietary system with Linux servers, undoubtedly, and I use a Linux desktop, but there's a lot of Windows servers and other sort of proprietary servers.
You actually virtualize some Windows servers through Linux, don't you?
Yeah. So we've got some virtual Windows servers and things. But I kind of think if I was to sort of talk to myself in 2000, 2001, I would have liked to have thought then that I would be doing something that was just Linux now.
Yeah.
And I'm not, it's still a mixture. And I still enjoy doing the Linux stuff, and I'm still okay and happy to do the Windows stuff.
Yeah, I can kind of relate to that. I have that separation of when I go to work, I do evil stuff that pays the bills and keeps my kids in shoes and food. But at the end of the workday, I can go and do stuff which is more enjoyable. I actually wrote a blog post about this, I think, about 3 years ago, doing the things I hate to fund the things I love, I think I called it. Because, you know, the stuff you do at work a lot of the time is not necessarily as enjoyable as the hacking away on Linux. That is, I think Linux has made computing more fun because there's just, it's, I know the comment we had in the feedback where someone said that they felt it was difficult moving from Windows to Linux because it's such a leap and he wouldn't know what to do. That is, I think, the best thing about Linux, is there's so much to
learn. Exciting times, actually, because when you do get rid of XP and all you've got is Linux, wow. You know, once you can get past the little niggles and you realise the power, it's exciting times.
Mm. Yeah, I do just wonder whether, you know, I remember when I was younger and idealistic, I should say, you know, thinking that anybody who didn't understand Linux and free software and see that this was obviously the right thing to do and the only way to go, I would think was just sort of narrow-minded or short-sighted and rail against them.
I'm still like that.
Well,
but you're pragmatic, though. You're still pragmatic. You will use, you know, some non-free software.
If we're talking about people, individuals, and when you say, look, you know, this one disk is so... It's so powerful. It's so trouble-free. Why don't you take it and give it a go? And I'm happy with what I've got. I get I get frustrated. I really can't help it.
I agree with that. But for somebody who tells me that, yeah, just like I would be annoyed if somebody told me there was only one way to do something on the server was with a Windows server, I can now see that me saying the only way you should do this on the server is with a Linux server is just as wrong. Whereas back then, I don't think I did. I think sort of the idealistic philosophy sort of overrode any other considerations. And whether I would now see myself now as a bit of a sellout or something, whether I've kind of not really stuck
true
to that.
Yeah.
Oh, good. Thanks.
No. I'm agreeing with you in the point that you might see yourself now as a bit of a sellout, as I am. You know, I know people, you know, have a go at me because I went out and bought a Mac, you know. Well, the fact is I've got non-free software on my Linux laptop. And, okay, I've got an Apple, which is almost completely, you know, non-free software. But I use Firefox and, you know, other, and it's got OpenOffice installed on it. So, you know, there's always these little outposts of free software, even in the non-free areas that I work. There's still...
Yeah, I think by its nature, Ubuntu is a pragmatist distribution. You know, it's for people who are more willing to sort of... They're not hardcore free software people, generally. Yeah. I mean, for example, how many people have a free software phone? And now there's no excuse, really. You know, I mean, how many people who you know, I'm going down that road. But, I mean, also on the same subject, I mean, a few years ago, I come across, and it's something which is, I do bring up more often than I should, this sort of GNU or GNU Linux, calling it that rather than Linux. A few years ago, I did actually think, oh, okay, that's what we should do.
Yeah.
You know, that's what we should do. And then I saw the sort of debates and the sort of... I actually went off the idea. So now I don't do that.
But you went off the idea not because you thought the idea of giving... we're rambling on about something else now, aren't
we? Well, yeah, it's reasonable. But I went off it for a pragmatic idea. And the pragmatic thing was it's too long to type. And so therefore I sacrificed what might be an idealistic standpoint of including the GNU Linux in it for reasons.
I'm more on the side that I think Dave is, that it was I deviated away from the whole GNU/Linux because I don't think it's as important to credit GNU as it is important to credit all the other packages. You know, what about the guy who wrote GNOME Power Manager? What about the guy who wrote Bluetooth stack? What about the guy who wrote, you know, this and that? Yeah, you know, these people are also worthy of thanks, and I don't want to exclude one thing for another.
Yeah, yeah.
I guess just to wrap it up, the one thing that I would tell my younger self would be that actually Linux is really going to gain a lot of strength in the marketplace, and you know you'll start to see Linux everywhere. It'll be in mainstream news articles on the BBC. You know, within a few years of you taking it up, not because you took it up, but know, it will go places and it will do stuff and it will really help empower people who do choose to use it.
If I could go back 15 years or so, I'd register two domain names, Google and Thought.
Linux.com, surely.
We're doing the competition now. £20 Canonical shop voucher is what the competition was for, and obviously we spun it around and did it slightly differently.
It was our back-to-front competition.
So the answer was Pulse Audio, and we had some really great entries. I think what we're going to do is we're going to read a few out, and then we'll pick a winner.
Yeah, thanks to everybody who sent their applies in. They gave us a good chuckle or two. The first entry was?
That was Craig Cabri.
Okay, and Craig's suggestion was, what sound server do many people blame for problems when in fact it's ALSA drivers that are the problem?
Meow.
is it? Yeah, well, it's strange because if I have an audio problem and I kill Pulse Audio, I'm still using ALSA and the problem tends to go away. Sorry, Craig.
Apparently the ALSA stuff hides it. That's what I've heard.
Right. Oh, okay. Fair enough. Well, maybe Craig could give us a voicemail or something and tell us a little bit more about why people blame Pulse Audio when it should be ALSA.
Mark Law sent in, solve the anagram. I use Duo Lap. Nice.
That sounds wrong.
It's fun. Does it actually work? Thought gone into that.
P-U-L-S-E.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, it does.
And we had one from Andrew, and he says, what words haunt Daniel Chen's nightmares? Now, he's the guy that works on Pulse Audio and stuff, isn't he?
For Ubuntu, yeah.
Ah, right. I didn't want to show my ignorance and say I didn't know who Daniel was. Jan Ritka, what does a doctor listen to when using a stethoscope?
Pulse Audio.
Ah, now that is good.
I like that, yeah.
Ed Hewitt writes, what is Ubuntu's Achilles heel?
Oh, harsh.
Ooh. Ooh, yeah, it's not a whole lot of enthusiasm, positive.
Not feeling the Pulse Audio love.
No.
And we had an entry from Ken Fallon, who said that he was going to appropriately record an audio submission for this competition, because it was about Pulse Audio.
Excellent.
And let's play it now.
Oh,
very yes. good, Ken. Thank very you very good. Much indeed.
But we couldn't hear it.
You little tinker. So now we've got to pick a winner from the entries that we've had.
I think it's unanimous, really, isn't it?
Yeah.
Jan.
Well done, mate.
Yeah. Apart from Dave, who just dissents.
Well, I was just going to disagree on principle.
Oh, right. Okay, fair enough.
You chose that one.
Oh, yeah, I did. Yeah, I was just going to disagree to be difficult.
So congratulations, Jan, with your What Does a Doctor Listen To When He's Using a Stethoscope. And we will email you the Canonical Shop voucher code, which you can just use on the online store.
Well done.
While we're talking about Pulse Audio, I just thought I'd mention in the updates for Karmic today, there was a nice configuration change that happened to
Pulse Audio. It was a huge patch, wasn't it?
Audio, and it had, there's a config file for Pulse Audio, and the line changed from disable-shm equals no to enable-shm equals yes.
So turning it on its head, how appropriate.
Rather like our little competition.
Yay! It's time to delve into the... Well, it was Ecosphere.
Mm-hmm. It's been several other things.
It's been Gerald, Harold, Phyllis, Dustafir, and Margaret.
What should we go for this week?
This time it's Nigella.
Nigella, ooh, I like that.
Or should it be dip into the Nutella?
No.
No.
Okay. It's Nigella.
What's in Nigella this week?
Perplume has written an interesting blog post about, well, he calls it the Aristocratic Desktop Part 3. There's no tray icon in GNOME. So he goes on to say, repeat after me one more time, there is no such thing as a tray icon in GNOME. GNOME has a notification area, which has nothing to do with the Windows-ish obscenity called SysTray. This little space where the application can put a little icon. I mean, seriously, have you ever thought about how completely stupid the idea of a tray icon? And he goes on.
Yes, he talks about why would it be called a tray? What does a tray do for anything?
Yes.
And the fact that a lot of applications are quite naughty and put icons in the notification area when perhaps they don't really need to have icons like Banshee and OpenOffice and things like that, sort of put things in that area. The only things that he argues should be there are network status information.
Clock.
The clock and one other thing, updates. Yeah, the notification, I think, for updates. I think that's right. And the fact that the whole SysTray thing is only called SysTray because the process in Windows is called SysTray. It's never been called, allegedly, it's never been called SysTray by Microsoft.
Oh, really?
Yeah, the people who did it, the process was called SysTray, one of the processes that was related to it, and that's what you used to see crash. So everybody started to call it the System Tray, thinking it was short for SysTray.
Hmm. I just say next to the clock.
Yeah, in the
corner. But it's a usability thing, because the word System Tray doesn't mean anything to anybody. Unless they happen to have grown up with this Microsoft misunderstanding. So calling it a notification area makes sense.
Yeah. Liam Green Hughes blogged, if someone designed a Ubuntu set-top box remix, what would it look like? Would it make sense to integrate functionality such as the ability to connect to a wireless network and update packages directly into software such as Boxy through plugins? Or would it be better to design something like Ubuntu Network Remix interface for TV with everything usable with a few button presses on a remote control?
Well, this obviously for you using Myth TV, you use Myth TV on Ubuntu, don't you?
I have been known to.
Yes.
He's Mr. Mythbuntu.
And I use Boxy on Ubuntu. Mm-hmm. And yes, I think what Liam's getting at is there, it would be good if there was a set-top box where you could do everything from the remote.
Yeah.
Because at the moment, I have to drop out of Boxy to do updates, which means I have to have a keyboard and mouse plugged in, or I SSH into the box.
Well, it's really a discussion between a computer and a computer appliance. Server and an appliance.
Yeah.
Now, when we were first forming Mythbuntu, we did actually have a discussion about whether we should have automatic updates, and it seemed like a bad idea.
Mm.
It is, and I often don't update my Mythbox at home because it, firstly, it's not externally accessible, so it's not subject to those sort of vulnerabilities from outside, but because it breaks, and Myth TV is a pain to configure, and then so therefore you don't want to install updates that may break it, and mean you have to go through a reconfiguration thing, when it's the thing that records your TV, which is the most important thing in the world.
I'm not so much bothered about automatic updates, more that there should be, and I think Liam talks more about that, there should be some interface. So in Myth TV, you could go to a settings button and say, do an update. Because, for example, my PVR, my set-top box, which is a shop-bought set-top box, has a button, and you press the button and it goes looking for over-the-air updates. Or you plug a serial cable in the back and you squirt a firmware update down the cable. Which is
but you like do it at the time geek. Of your choosing.
Yes, and to be but able there's to, a button to do it.
Yeah, to be able to do it from the remote is the ideal.
Yeah,
really.
I don't have to plug a keyboard into it. Sounds like an SSH in.
Sounds like an interesting project. Hopefully they'll make it happen.
DGL is an open source, GPL licensed game manager written in Python 2.5 for the GNU Linux operating system. It's inspired by Valve's Steam software for Windows.
Can I make a guess? Can I guess that it was Alan that added this?
What, because it's Python?
Because you had the Pi game library last episode that was in the news.
Actually, no. I just think that there needs to be a way to easily install games. And a lot of people use, or a lot of games use that Steam system on Windows and to be able to easily install and update games. And if we had a way to easily deploy games out to Linux users, then that might be a good way to help promote games on Linux. There's an interesting bug report that was filed after Jono created this Ubuntu community project within Launchpad for people to file community-based bugs. The bug number is 392799, and part of it reads, #Ubuntu, which is the IRC channel, it says, is too noisy. 2,000 people is 10 times too many people to have in one IRC channel and expect people to be able to get the help they need. Assuming an average lurker ratio, symptoms of this problem include people constantly asking in the wrong IRC channels after being lost in the noise in #Ubuntu.
Yeah, I've had that experience with other sort of very popular free software project channels. You just ask a question and it just
scrolls off the top of the screen.
Because everybody else is asking their question as well, and there's not enough people there answering the questions.
Someone did suggest removing people that don't say anything.
That's not a bad idea.
Well, I lurk in there, and sometimes, and I look out for, well, another suggestion was to look for keywords.
Highlights.
So I have my IRC channel highlighting certain words.
That's what I do.
And when someone asks a question in that channel, my IRC client pops up and says, oh, someone mentioned screencasts in that. And I'll jump in there and go, here's the best program for it, and here's the how-to.
Yeah, but then you're talking in the channel, aren't you?
You can't remove people that are lurking. Otherwise, you'd never have anybody in there. You just have loads and loads of people asking questions and nobody to answer them.
That's a good point.
That seems to be the situation now, though.
Well, no, but people might be busy answering other people's questions. So I could be sat there, and there's no way I can... Well, before now, I've answered three people's questions in a row and been dealing with three people at a time.
Yeah, okay.
You know, because they go away and try something, and then the next person asks a question. But then you get to a limit that your brain can multitask a certain number of people at once.
But how many people do you help in the course of a week?
Oh, I don't know. I dip in and out.
Well, so
I don't know.
The way I've done this is to go into the specific apps IRC channel. If I've got a problem with an application, go onto Launchpad, find out where that app hangs out on IRC, and go to the channel.
See, that also has a problem, because we've had complaints from upstream software projects saying, don't send your users here. You should be dealing with them in your own channel.
No, if it's an application problem.
Yeah, but the trouble is sometimes you also get the disparity between what the actual upstream create and the modifications we insert in there. Like, for example, the kernel we actually use is nothing like the vanilla kernel you get from kernel.org.
ZA Reason or ZAR Reason have released the Terra A20 netbook with Ubuntu, Kubuntu, or even Edubuntu. And System76 have announced the Gazelle Ultra netbook with Ubuntu. So a couple of new netbook releases there.
Yeah, I don't think either are available in the UK, but you know,
So it's good to see Ubuntu being
shipped. The fun thing about the Gazelle Ultra is that you get a nice Ubuntu badge on the case.
I noticed that, and that's why I thought it was worth mentioning.
On the front. Yeah, where like an Apple logo would be.
on the lid?
Wow. I mean, from the picture, it looks quite nice.
Unless that was Photoshopped in. I mean, gimped in.
And to be honest, with Gazelle, they've gone with the whole kind of Ubuntu naming scheme. Yeah. You know, it's sort of very Ubuntu-y. You could see that being a release in the future.
I wonder if we can get them to send us one for review.
I think your alphabet is a bit screwy if you think Gazelle is going to be in the future.
Well,
given we're currently on K.
There's only 26 letters in the alphabet, and I can see Ubuntu going well into the future.
Is he using the Roman alphabet, or is he using another one?
Special Tony alphabet.
Karmic Alpha 4 is out. It was announced on the Ubuntu Devel main list, and it's been on various blogs and planets.
Mm.
Excellent. What's in it?
Karmic.
New. Ubuntu 1 ships by default. Oh, that was another thing that we found out today.
Yes.
Yeah, that's really cool. In fact, that's the next thing on the list, but we'll mention it now because we're talking about Karmic. Elliot Murphy posted a message on Identica. Just a brief message saying, I wonder how many people know that Ubuntu 1 is going to ship and we're going to give a free 2 gig storage.
He did say storage free, which sounds quite promising.
Yeah.
Yes.
And, but to be fair, he did correct that.
Okay. And that means that anyone who installs Karmic and connects their Ubuntu 1 or signs up for Ubuntu 1 gets 2 gig of free storage.
Do we know how they're going to use it? And what I mean by that is there an Ubuntu 1 folder? Or does it take, as was suggested before, the whole of your home directory?
It's an Ubuntu 1 folder.
Yeah, there's no way they could attack your whole home like that, I don't think.
Not with just 2 gig, anyway. That would be a good trap, wouldn't it? Make your home folder on Ubuntu 1 and then send you the bill after it's synced online.
But there's also going to be a beta version that has the next set of features that are going to go in Ubuntu 1.
Exciting times.
Mm. The patent policy has been published. That's a lot of P's. It's up on wiki.ubuntu.com/patent policy. Jono Bacon had a good hand in writing it, but it's come from the discussions of the various boards to try and establish Ubuntu's position on patents, software patents.
Because, I mean, this is an issue that's been raised a few times now, and this is actually, the patent policy has actually been approved now, hasn't it? So,
yep, technical boards had a go at it. I think they're the main people who've driven it.
Well, they took advice from, obviously the man at the top is Mark Shuttleworth, and his advice to the technical board was, if we have someone claiming there's a patent violation, then obviously we need to do something about it. But until there is a claim of a patent violation, so woolly rumours about things might infringe someone's patent aren't good enough.
Like the M word.
Yes, like the M word we don't speak of. Yes.
So... there are procedures in the policy for, as you say, for rights holders trying to report an alleged patent violation. And there's also a procedure for developers inquiring about possible patent violations.
Oh, interesting.
Something that's also quite interesting. If you take out Ubuntu support from Canonical, they actually insure you against any patent infringement things that would be taken out against you.
Do they? That's interesting.
Yeah, I saw it in
the Red Hat do.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's the end of the... Nigella.
We've got a load of your feedback from the last couple of episodes, and Dave's going to kick it off.
We had an email from Ian Wild. He said,
I wonder if you'd consider doing an overview on App Center once Karmic's release date gets closer, so we can have an audio peek before it gets released into the wild.
I have no idea what App Center is.
No, neither have I.
I'm thinking it might be a new software installation thing that's better than add remove programs.
I think essentially it's the center of apt.
Okay, well, so basically what we're saying, Ian, is we're happy to do a feature on it once we've worked out what it is. Or maybe if there's an apt center expert out there who'd like to come on and talk to us about it on the show, then get in touch.
That would be good. Andy Britton gave us a voicemail, and it says...
Hi there, my name's Andy Britton. I suppose you'd call me an IT professional. And just wanted to say that I very much like the podcast, enjoy the format, it's very jovial, and I like the banter, it's great fun to listen to. In terms of a question, the thing that stopped me going from sort of Microsoft to open source and Ubuntu is basically that you stick me in front of a Windows machine, and I know how to fix it. Stick me in front of a Ubuntu machine, I've got no clue. And that's the leap that I've got to make somehow. So if there's anything that you can suggest to help me on that journey, that'd be fantastic. Thanks a lot for the podcast. Cheers, bye.
Hmm.
There you go.
Problem solving.
Cheers, Andy.
Good email. There's voicemail. Thank you.
There's some work going on to do a thing called signposts, and part of that is helping people to find the right documentation for the thing they need. Because one of the problems we have is like the wiki is just like a big mass of information, and there's man pages everywhere. But what they're trying to do is create an easier to find troubleshoot, you know, type thing on the wiki. So that might help.
I was probably the last person in this room to do this, actually, and I remember the day I did it because I dual booted between XP and Debian at the time, and in fact it was you, Al, who said to me, do you know what, get rid of XP, it's the only way you're going to learn.
Yeah.
And it is, and yeah. It's absolutely right, because when you get to something difficult, what you do is, oh damn, you reboot, go into XP, do whatever it is you want to do, and yeah, and you, but you never learn. The only thing you can do is just say, do you know what, I've got to cut it, get rid of Windows, get rid of XP, get Ubuntu on there, and find a mentor, somebody somewhere that will, for a period of time, say, yeah, what you need to do is this, what you need to do is that. And when he says, just Google it, then you know you've reached the point of him showing you everything. And that's what you got to do.
Of course, there is a problem there, because if, I mean, many people don't use a computer as a hobby, they use it as an instrument. So if you actually try and switch like cold turkey, as you described there, there's going to be a time there of lower productivity, isn't there? So how do you actually combat that?
Well, I think that's why you need a mentor or someone, you know, a go-to guy that you can contact who can, you know, help you get over those times.
Of course, online we've got the sort of the loco channels and the mailing lists and things like that. And of course, there's LUGs, local Linux user groups as well, isn't
and
there?
And books, more and more, there are Ubuntu books.
Funny you say that. We'll get onto that.
But we get a fair amount of people joining the Ubuntu UK channel asking for support, like completely random, you know, out of nowhere. And they just turn up and say, you know, I'm having a problem with my video card, sound card, or whatever it might be. And volunteers just sit there and help. And now, we're not the official support channel. The official support channel is #Ubuntu on IRC, but that can be seen to be very, very busy. But join our channel, ask a question if you're
in fact, inclined. Actually, maybe we could even do a segment on getting support in the upcoming episode.
Yeah, that'd be good.
But I agree 100% with Simon. I did the same thing, you know, dual booted for ages because I had everything set up in Windows the way I liked it. And it was only when my hard drive died and I lost the Windows installation, and I thought, well, it's now or never, really. Just go with it, put Ubuntu on it, and you, it was Debian at the time, and you force yourself to learn new things. Everybody who's a Windows expert now has been not a Windows expert at some point in the past, and they've learned it all. Now, I can understand for work you might not want to make a harsh change, that, you know, there'd be training needs and things, because you obviously got to make sure you're productive without a big break, but for your home use, you know, go for it. Just bite the bullet and get on, use the support channels, use the loco, use the IRC.
You're not on your own,
and chances are anything you want to do with your computer, somebody else has done it already.
I'm going to turn that on its head slightly and say what my experience was. I was dual booting, and eventually I got to a stage where I thought, well, hang on, I haven't actually booted into Windows for like over a month and a half now. I don't need it anymore.
when you're in that situation and you boot into Windows and every single application opens asking to be updated, you know it's time to switch.
But also when you actually get annoyed that Windows doesn't work as you expect, because you're now more familiar with no.
Yeah, that's a great position to be in.
Yeah,
frustrating but great.
Well, I think we should say good luck to Andy, and yeah, let us know how you get on.
Yeah, yeah. Or drop by the channel and say hi.
Satipara, I think it is. Satipara emailed in and said,
"I'm listening to your podcast now. I think it's really good. However, I felt compelled to email to ask the person who keeps saying wow all the time to please stop. Keep up the good work." Yeah, that would be me.
Wow.
Who's that?
I think you guys identified me as the person who said, well,
I don't know. I think I might be one of them as well.
I think it was during a telephone interview we did with Dustin Kirtland. Yeah, that's right. It was. And he was saying quite cool stuff, and I kept going, wow. And I'm sorry.
Yeah, so perhaps replace it with something equally annoying.
What, replace me? With something equally annoying. I don't think that's possible.
You could try saying jeepers or something like that instead.
Jingies or something. Okay.
Yeah. Cool, blimey, governor.
I will go away and make it my mission to find out something less annoying to say.
So we need to thank Aaron Nash and Andrew Smith, who've been helping us debug the problem with playing OGG files on various Cowan and Samsung OGG players. The problem we have worked out is to do with the cover art, the embedded cover art.
Which the PictR logo.
Yeah, so the little UUPC logo. And it seems that some players don't like it and crash. There is an upgraded firmware for the Cowan players, which you can get from the website, which doesn't really fix the problem. Instead of crashing the player, it just refuses to play the file.
Oh, right.
So I suppose that's better in some ways.
So it's better in a way. Do they find this on other podcasts or only ours?
I think we're the only people who bothered to firstly do an OG version and secondly to embed cover art in it.
I think Linux Outlaws do.
Maybe they don't embed cover art in their OG version. I don't know.
Mm.
But it does seem to be a genuine problem. So we've got to think, is it worth us just getting rid of the cover art for the OG version for the people who listen to it on the Cowan and Samsung type devices, or
have a separate RSS feed for
people with broken
Aaron Nash and a separate RSS feed for Andrew Smith.
But it has been, at least we know what the problem is now. We're just going to decide what to do about it.
Okay, cool.
So thank you for your help, guys.
Paul from the Land Down Under emailed in,
"I've just re-listened to the first podcast from season 2. At the end of it, you read my letter and made a comment that you will have to have a 4-hour and 1-minute podcast, so it's just longer than my daily commute."
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I remember that now.
"For the last few months, I have changed from driving all the way to the train station and taking the train. So it's now a 3-hour each way or 6-hour total."
Ouch. That's a long commute.
Actually, that's longer than some people actually work in a day.
Speaking from personal experience,
lots of time to listen to the podcast about Linux, etc.
Wow. So we've got to do 6-hour long shows or 6-hour and 1-minute long shows just to mark it all up again.
Well, what you could do is slow the playback down so it takes longer. I know some people who speed it up to make it, you know, make their life get some of their hours of their life back. But no, we're not going to talk that long. It may seem like it that we do, but we have not.
Aldo Noguera emailed in,
"When I was listening to the last episode, Season 2, Episode 9, I suddenly noticed that you were talking about someone who had the same problem that I had. Interesting. And then I realised it was me. I rewound the podcast to where you spoke my name, and it was so weird that I couldn't recognise it."
Ah.
So we probably just compounded that again. Yeah. "I'm not complaining. It's just very funny. And you had not a clue from where I am from. By the way, he lives in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil, and they speak Portuguese."
How fantastic is that?
Yeah, it's great.
Someone in Brazil is listening to us.
I know, and that's, we can't say his name correctly.
Yeah,
what you need really to do, Aldo, is ring our voicemail number, which may be a bit expensive internationally, but, you know.
Or record a WAV file of you saying your name. Or record a WAV file,
yeah, saying your name, like the Linus Torvalds clip.
Do one that says, "My name is Aldo, and your proper name, and I listen to the Ubuntu UK podcast."
Excellent. Please do that. That would be brilliant. And that's all your feedback for this time.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for listening, and thanks to everyone who took part via Twitter and Identica. If you'd like to get a hold of us, you can email the show via podcast@ubuntu-uk.org.
You can leave us a voicemail on a number of ways. You can telephone 0845 508 and 1986, or point your VoIP client at podcast@sip.ubuntu-uk.org. And finally, if you Skype, you can record a message via Skype using Ubuntu UK Podcast as our Skype name.
You can send us your comments via Identica and Twitter as well, using identi.ca/UUPC or twitter.com/UUPC, as well as getting updates from recording sessions and getting your chance to put questions to our interviewee guests.
Alternatively, if you're into IRC, you can chat to us via the #Ubuntu-UK channel on the Freenode IRC network.
Join our Facebook fan page.
209.
Really? That's not bad. Search for Ubuntu a UK podcast.
I think we said we wanted to hit 200 before the end of the year, so we've done that. That's nice. Good.
Oh, wow. Well done.
Of course, 50 of them are Tony.
And his various alter egos and secret projects.
Yeah.
We welcome suggestions, material, tips, reviews or rants and feedback, both positive and negative, so please do get in touch.
Thanks also to our network of community mirrors who are listed on the website.
Thanks for listening, everyone.
Yep.
Goodbye.
Join us next time. Bye.
Bye.